refiner of silver. Brother Norby.
Well, for those of you who have not already heard, I'll bring you the Christian love and greetings of our home class, Patterson, New Jersey, and more particularly of Sister Norby. The refiner of silver. Behold, I will send Malachi 3:1-3. Behold, I will send my messenger, and he shall prepare the way before me. And the Lord whom ye seek shall suddenly come to his temple, even the messenger of the covenant whom ye delight in. Behold, he shall come, saith the Lord of hosts. But who may abide the day of his coming? And who shall stand when he appeareth? For he is like a refiner's fire, and like fuller's soap. And he shall sit as a refiner and purifier of silver. And he shall purify the sons of Levi and purge them as gold and silver, that they may offer unto the Lord an offering in righteousness. Now, you'll notice here that it mentions silver twice. He is specifically a refiner of silver. But then it brings in the gold, too. And he purged the sons of Levi as gold and silver. Because the sons of Levi, representing the spiritual class, will turn out to be either gold, divine nature, little flock, or silver, a great company. But the big work of the Lord is with the silver. Partly because there's so much of it in proportion. Secondly, because the silver class are not the obedient children, they're the disobedient children. They are not the voluntary sacrificers, they are the involuntary sacrificers. The Lord has to put them through special refining and purifying. And so that is the important work of the Lord upon his return. This prophecy in Malachi shows that. And we have witnessed the truth of that, too, in our observation and in our experiences. Now we want to, this really talk merges into the one I gave yesterday. And we want to touch upon some of the aspects of the trials, and particularly of the relatively small differences that there are among us. We trust that we have emphasized the positive, and we don't intend to overpower or overshadow the positive with any negative thoughts here this afternoon. In fact, I don't have any negative thoughts with respect to you, brethren, as a group, and I don't feel that our little differences, as I illustrated, they are the little squeaks that we only noticed after we got rid of the big rumble. And so I don't intend to exaggerate them out of proportion. But if we can clear up some misunderstandings, that'll be all to the good. Because while we can tolerate these differences, it's just as important that we minimize the differences, and we'd have that much less to tolerate. But we should be able to tolerate all these little differences that we might have. Now, I'd like to mention some of the things that I don't believe, because I think maybe, along with others, I've been misunderstood and misquoted and so forth. So I'd like to emphasize some of the things that I don't believe. I don't believe that there is any salvation outside of Christ, that there is no basis for any fellowship, even for the Christian denominations who do not believe in Christ as their personal Savior, who think of Him merely as a good example, but an ordinary sinful man. There's absolutely no basis for their faith, and they couldn't possibly be brethren. The whole that view, the modernist, so-called modernist view. And also, I don't believe that there is a tremendous work ahead of us. There is some work, definitely, to the very end of our course. But we shouldn't take ourselves too seriously and attempt to do over work that has already been done. And I think that I think I'll pull my seniority on you. I'm getting along to that stage now. Our family got the truth in 1914. And while I was just a boy at the time, I think I came right along with my parents into the truth. I remember my uncle came to Central Montana, where we were at the time, and he brought all the books out there. And the early summer of 1914. The thing that I'll always remember was he says, "Look out for this fall of 1914. He says, "Gentile times are ending." He says, "The kings are going to lose their thrones, and the colonial powers are going to lose their colonies and cease to rule the world, as they did in 1914. So you can imagine how impressed I was when World War I broke out right on time in fulfillment of those expectations. Now, that was almost 62 years ago. And we've rejoiced in that message, and we see no reason to change it all this time. Now, if we didn't get you on that point of seniority, maybe we have another one. That the wife and I married in the Lord 50 years ago, January 1st of this year. We're celebrating our golden wedding anniversary. They have been 50 glorious years together in the Lord, and maybe I got you on that one. There are some senior members here that predate me, I realize that, but I'm talking to the vast majority of you. I can speak to you as a senior elder. And we don't want to discount the seniority. There's nothing to be proud of, actually. We all get it if time goes on. There's nothing exclusive about seniority, where it's bound to overtake us. But everything being equal, I think that seniority is an asset. It's a talent. Now, I think I can prove that to you in a few seconds. I doubt if there's hardly anyone here who would exchange their present knowledge and wisdom and experience, particularly wisdom, for 20 years earlier in their life. And that goes on until we actually get into senility. However, at whatever age we are, we think we're just about the right spot. And it reminds me, I was talking to a first or second grader one time. We were talking about school. And we happened to mention that these children just starting in kindergarten. And so I remarked, they've got a lot to learn. And this first or second grader says, "They sure have." We're quite grown up, you see. Well, we might expect that of the teenagers. And they do feel, you know, that at 30 you're over the hill. Physically, maybe we have passed our prime. But actually, we're only entering into the richer part of our lives. Now, the one thing about seniority is that we witness history repeating itself. If we've been in the truth that long, we've seen history repeating itself two or three times. It seems that every generation of Bible students goes through very much the same experience and trial. And having gone through one experience of that, it really helps us to be prepared for the next one. Now, those who've never gone through an experience previously, they've got to battle our way through the hard way. A harder way, anyway, but it's not easy for any of us. Because these tests can be very subtle. Now, we've had differences, for instance, about people in the nominal church. And as I say, I'm hoping to sort of moderate the views, if anything. And we might say that we have the pros and the cons. Pros, those who think that there is spirit begetting in the nominal church. And the cons, those who do not think that there is any spirituality in the nominal church. I'm sort of a modified pro myself. And that's why I want to emphasize some things that I don't believe that might be associated with the pro view. I don't believe that all of the plagues are in the future. I think we're pretty well through the plagues. And as I say, I don't think that we have the task of waking up the great company class. The great company class that exist will have to have their flesh destroyed, their idols destroyed, and the chart does not show the great company class leaving Babylon. It shows Babylon leaving the great company class. It shows the great company class, the final members, being released from Babylon when she completely falls, physically destroyed. And this idea of a great work to awaken the great company class is not a new idea. Rather, it was introduced in 1919. And I can document this. We're in the original reprints, which go through 1919, you'll find on page 6379, bottom, and 6380, top of the page, and we will quote directly. This is explaining the business meeting in 1919. There was not an expression of dissatisfaction to be heard on the part of any shareholder present. And it was manifest that all were determined to work shoulder to shoulder during the months that are before us in carrying forward the great work which we believe the Lord in His providence has for His church to do ere their exaltation to heavenly glories beyond the veil of death. The outstanding thought entertained by the brethren throughout the convention, and particularly at its close, seemed to be that the society's work in the future will be blessed to the spreading of the truth on a hitherto unprecedented scale, and that the numerous thousands of sleeping Christians, quote, foolish virgins, shall be aroused from their slumbers to a recognition of the presence of the Lord and the establishment of His kingdom upon the ruins of the existing order. Reprint 6380. Now, they were saying that they were going to awaken the great company class and bring them into the truth. Well, the chart doesn't show the great company class leaving Babylon. voluntarily. Some of them might. But all the way through the pastor's writings, he shows that many of the great company class will not be released until Babylon falls physically. In other words, someone will cease to be Methodist and Baptist when there is no Methodist or Baptist church. That's what he's saying. And so this idea, I think, that if we don't press this point of great work ahead of us, it would smooth out some of the differences between us. Because I know for a fact that it's not so much a question of where of there being spirit begotten in a nominal church. It's how it would affect our work if we believe one way or the other. And that's why I think that we should narrow this gap to a large extent. And those who take themselves too seriously and are urging everybody to engage in some specific work along the lines introduced here by the judge, they are now doing a disservice to those of us who have the modified pro view on this subject. Now, of course, the other point of view, the extreme con view, was introduced from the same source. The judge had his followers parading around with sandwich signs out in front of the church doors, particularly the Catholics, during Mass, declaring that religion is a snare and a racket. Now, they had no regard at all for, they didn't distinguish between the systems and individuals in the system. Now, time and again, I've never made an issue of this in years past. I was associated with brethren with the extreme con view. The con view. I've heard over and over again that the nominal churches don't even worship the same God that we do. Now, where are you going to find that in the pastor's writing? That's the extreme con view. And that aggravates these differences between us. The pastor distinguished between the systems and some of the individuals that would be in the system. Now, besides, we don't have to start from scratch to tell the people about Babylon's condition. I have articles, a review of a certain article in which the Catholics hadn't left the church exactly, but they had gone underground, and they called Babylon everything that the strongest language you find in the Bible. Now, she's all of that, but she's still our mother. Now, that's a ridiculous position, isn't it? Nevertheless, it's true. And Jezebel is having trouble with their eunuchs, just like Jezebel of old, the type, was thrown down by the eunuchs, her own servants. Jehu said, "Throw her down," and they promptly obeyed him. But in the meantime, Jezebel had painted her face. She wanted to change her image. And we witnessed this change of image, too, or an attempt at a change of image, but it was too late to save Jezebel. It caused a lot of consternation among the followers. Now, the mission of the church, we want to emphasize again, is, I think, beautifully set forth in the first volume. I remember in the late 20s, about 50 years ago, there was a radical change in the position of the society, and one of the representatives called on us, and upon learning who we were, old-time Bible students, they said, "Oh, yes, you're living back in the Philadelphia stage of the church." "Oh, brother Lowell," he said, "now we're in the Laodicean period of the church, period of judgment. justice for the people. And now it's time for us to strike out and plague and destroy Babylon. That was the first time I heard that they had moved us back into the Philadelphia stage of the church. Now, you see, that confirms what we have mentioned here, see, that their work radically changed in there. And they have been plaguing and annoying and harassing Babylon ever since. They claim that they're the Lord's great army. Well, they can have it. They're almost at the head of the Lord's great army. They're the spearhead of the Lord's great army. But if you read about the character of the Lord's great army, you wouldn't want to be particularly associated with it. They're not the Lord's in any other sense than the fact that they want to do what the Lord wants done at a given time. They're just a part of the wrecking crew. And they don't have to follow any blueprints in doing the wrecking. A general contractor has a wrecking crew and a construction crew. He doesn't pay much attention to the wrecking crew. He lets them go ahead and tear the old structure down so he can put up the new building. But he's very particular about the construction crew. And we want to be a part of the construction crew, don't we? And we've got to follow the blueprints. And the blueprints are more or less up here. You know, if we think that there's something wrong with the chart, we're really disclosing the fact that our eyesight is failing. Suppose you go into an optician's office and you say, "Doctor, why don't you get some decent figures up here? Decent diagrams. Those circles you got up there aren't round. And you know the lines, the diagonal lines one direction, aren't the same as they're going in the other direction." He says, what else do you see? And you go on and mention two or three other things, and he says, "Okay, you go right on talking. I'll soon know what kind of glasses you need." And so when we're confronted with changes on this chart, well, they're not going to bring out a new chart. No. But if you explain what you believe, anyone can tell you whether it conforms to the chart or whether you'd have to change the chart to accommodate that view. And as I mentioned yesterday, there's at least a dozen changes on that chart that would have to be made to accommodate some of the prevailing ideas among the Bible students today. And I don't go along with that. No, that chart is accurate as far as I'm concerned. And it doesn't pretend to be in proportion. But the figures are in the right position on that. Now, the pastor mentions what our mission is in the present order. On page 341 in the first volume. Well, incidentally, this witness that came around said that this is a new light now. This is a new approach. We go out and hammer Babylon and point out the errors and so on. Away with this gentle approach. See? I said, "Well, I've got news for you." I said, your approach now is different, but don't try to tell me it's anything new. I said, "You know that the pastor discarded your method after trying it for 5 years when he wrote the first volume in 1886. And in the foreword to the first volume, he said, for about 5 years preceding the first publication of that volume, we had substantially the same material under a different name, Food for Thinking Christians. It was differently presented. That first of all attacked the errors and demolished them, and then set up the structure of truth. But he said, we finally learned back in 1886 that that was not the best way. People became alarmed when they saw their errors falling and failed to read far enough to get the truth. So he says the first volume was written from a reverse standpoint. It shows the truth, the strength and beauty, and then suggests the removal of the error as being unnecessary and injurious. She didn't have any comeback on that, of course, either. She couldn't claim that their method was new. when it had been tried out from 1881 to 1886. And so it's in keeping with that approach that the pastor makes this advice as far as witnessing to the truth is concerned. By probing and inflaming either real or fancied wounds and wrongs, we would do injury to those we should be helping and blessing, thus spreading their discontent and hence their trouble. This is the bottom of page 341. But by fulfilling our mission, what is it? Preaching the good tidings of a ransom given for all, that's an italicized, and the consequent blessings to come to all, we shall be true heralds of the kingdom, its ambassadors of peace. Now, is this going to change as we get farther into the time of trouble? No. The troubles of this day of Jehovah, page 342, will give opportunity for preaching the good tidings of coming good, such as is seldom afforded, and blessed are they who follow the footsteps of the Master and be the good Samaritans, binding up the wound and pouring in the oil and wine of comfort and cheer. But the Lord's people should have no sympathy with the arrogant, insatiate desires and endeavors of any class. Their utterances should be calm and moderate, and always for peace where principle is not at stake. They should remember that it is the Lord's battle, and that so far as politics or social questions are concerned, they have no real solution other than that predicted in the Word of God. The duty of the consecrated, therefore, is first of all to see that they are not in the way of Jehovah's chariot, and then to stand still and see the salvation of God. In the sense of realizing that it is no part of their work to share in the struggle, but that it is the Lord's doing through other agencies. And we shouldn't take ourselves too seriously and think that we have to lead every crusade and, like a little quarterback, feel that he has to knock down all the big men in the opposing line. He has other more important work to do. He calls the plays all right. And like Jeremiah, we are, like the Lord told Jeremiah, he's at him for the pulling down of all the nations. He was not a military man. All he did was predicted it. But it's pretty late in the day to predict the troubles upon the present order, don't you think? When so much of the destruction is already taking place. But we shouldn't take ourselves too seriously, but continue to preach the gospel. My thought is that we're not supposed to chop out a chip and throw it at somebody, but hew to the line and let the chips fall where they may. Leave it to the Holy Spirit for people to take whatever part of the message really applies to them. And they'll pick it up on whatever level they happen to be operating on. Now, that's my feeling in that regard. And I think that that's a moderate view. I think that it's a practical view, and I think if we could all get together on this basis of putting out these volumes and let the Lord do the work, we would eliminate much of the tendency toward friction, because it's the work that causes the trouble. A difference of idea of what we should be doing. And we should be able to get together on this rational, reasonable position and not go off as these brethren did over 50 years ago. Now, another thing that I don't believe, some brethren who have the pro view think that the image of Daniel 2 has not been struck. That's all in the future. Now, I want to disassociate myself from that viewpoint completely, because it's really out of harmony with the harvest message, and it certainly is not conforming to the physical facts in the case. And it can be quickly demonstrated that it was a pastor's thought, and it's a scriptural thought, that when the lease expired, that the eviction began. Reprint 3389, Arisen Saints and the Living Faithful Set Up as Changed After Death. The smiting began in 1914. 5735, July 1915, we believe that the present strife in Europe is only the beginning of the great trouble and overthrow, the breaking to pieces of the nations as a potter's vessel. 5516, such a war as is now progressing, this is August 1914, will surely bring no great victory to any. The great Armageddon battle of the future, the great Armageddon battle of the scriptures will have been only partially fought with the end of the war, it's thought. 5845, did the times of the Gentiles end by October 1914? It certainly looks very much as if they did. The great nation of the world there began to go to pieces under the terrible shaking process there began. The shaking is still going on, day by day, week by week. Continue until the work of destruction is complete. Now, I blame the prominent leaders for perhaps driving some brethren to the other extreme, because their position was that the image represented the right to rule. Or in other words, it was tantamount to the lease. And, of course, the lease ends at a given time. And so their contention was that the image just ceased to exist after October 1914. Well, you can't harmonize all the pastor's statements on that, where he speaks of smiting is still going on after 1914. And so some brethren went to the other extreme and insisted that it's all in the future, and still in the future, you see. And we have one brother who is promoting this idea of everything in the future. He says, although the pastor has in some cases linked the fighting with World War I, yet in the below cited instances, he looks for this as a future event. This latter view, in our humble judgment, seems more scripturally sound. We do not say that those who think differently are wrong, however. Well, in other words, this brother, he's set up a contradiction, and then he chooses which idea he wants to believe. Or where does the pastor's authority come in a case like that? It just disappears. It's this brother's opinion that prevails. And he's using the references of the pastor to prove his particular point of view. And he doesn't try to harmonize. Now, I claim that all the references on this subject can be harmonized. For instance, this is the strongest point that is raised. It is on November 15th, 1914. It says, this stone kingdom is quarried out of the earth by the Lord. It is at first insignificant in size, and it seems to the world as powerless. But as soon as set up in power, this kingdom will smite the great image. Now, this is really the main reference that is given on this subject. And it's rather difficult to harmonize. So I looked through the scripture index to locate the scriptures that were used in this article. I figured that it was a rewritten article. It was not a current events article. The subject was the establishment of the kingdom, and so on. And I did find an article in 1898 in which this very paragraph was written. In other words, the pastor had rewritten an article in 1898, added something to it, and evidently pigeonholed it for use when he got real busy. Now, he was real busy in November 1914 with the photodrama. Otherwise, you'd have the pastor contradicting himself, saying the image had been struck in August. That it had not been struck in November, that it was struck in January or February. Now, when you set up a contradiction like that, where is the authority? Another one is in the first volume, where he says that when complete, the stone will smite the image. Well, he's refuting the papal claim mentioned on the preceding page, that it was the stone that smote the pagan Rome and did fill the whole earth. And he refutes that claim. He says it isn't way back there in the year 500 or something, but it's down when the church is complete that this work will go on. See the point? But in any case, everything written before 1914 has to be modified in connection with his statement, the correction at, about 1914. Now everything, another one is, says the, in the days of these kings, did it to smite the image and grind it to powder, and the stone is to become a great mountain or a kingdom of the Lord in all the earth. This smiting, we believe, is near at hand. This was 1915. The present war of Europe being instituted of the Lord to weaken the nations, prepare them for the next stage of trouble. Now, he isn't saying here in this article that the smiting had not begun. But it was to be a smiting of the image, it was grinding it to powder, and the wind blowing it away. Now, that process had only begun. The Tsar was still on the throne. The Kaiser was still on the throne. The nation still controlled the world. You see, the bulk of the smiting was still in the future. But he isn't denying that it had started. Now, there's another reference in July 1915. That in 57:16, the smiting of the image which will grind it to powder will come not from the church in the flesh, but with carnal weapons, but from the church in kingdom glory, backed by divine power. Now the context shows that this is an answer to a brother in Britain who refused to cooperate with the government in any sense of the word. He says the lease had expired and he was refusing to cooperate in any way at all. Well, the pastor is merely reminding him, now don't take yourself too seriously. You're not going to do this overthrowing. Leave it to the risen saints and the present Lord. And you tag along and keep praying, thy kingdom come, and sign the death warrant for these nations. That's what he's telling them. You see, if you read the context, you can readily see how that's true. So everything on this subject is harmonized with the thought that the smiting began. I would say that we shouldn't say that the image was smit in 1914. That has a connotation of past tense, see. But the image was struck in 1914. And it had to be ground to powder before the wind could blow it away. And I think that is pretty well accomplished today. It's universal dominion that is represented by the image. These nations existed as nations before they were pictured in the image. And there will be nations after the image has disappeared. As nations, but not universal rulers. There's not a colony now in all of Africa. That's how far advanced we are on that point. That's why I want to disassociate myself with this idea that the smiting of the image has not yet begun. And some brethren who hold the pro-view believe that. And it more or less reflects on the rest of us, too. So it's important that this is mentioned. Well, this thought of the great work that the Lord is doing. He's working with the gold and the silver, particularly the silver. And there's a lot of silver in the world today. The furnace has never been so hot. The present time and the time ahead of us, the Lord is working at top speed. The furnace has never been so hot before that the Lord could work at top speed in refining the gold and the silver. And it's after the Lord's goat is complete that the Lord will work with the scapegoat as a class. He works with them as individuals, turning them over to Satan for the destruction of the flesh. He's been doing that all through the age, and he's continuing to do that. But at the very end, he's going to deal with them as a class. And he'll destroy their images. He'll destroy the religious systems in which they are bound and free them in that respect. And it's the heat of this day in which we're living that is enabling the Lord to work so fast. There's a great work that the Lord is doing in that regard. And I do feel that we should be on the alert, do whatever we can do, but to not to take ourselves too seriously, because the Lord is doing these things through other agencies, you see. And we want to be active in the noblest work and on the highest level. So may we realize what is really taking place, and not to emphasize the negative aspects of the truth to the destruction of the sweet fellowship which we enjoy as a group, having escaped some of the more serious errors which really are besetting the majority of our fellowship at the present time. The Lord add his blessing.